19.
4, 3.
Where we kick ass.
2, 1.
Hey, Sequoia.
I'm Noel Wright with Daya Carolyn, and we're your hosts today for our second KA19 podcast. Daya, how are you today? And what's the lineup?
I'm doing great, Noel. I can't wait to start this week's episode of our KA19 podcast. If you remember, we had Debbie Castro, a dispatch supervisor with the Ventura County Sheriff's Department, visit 2 weeks ago. Continuing with similar topics, we have Adrian and Chris in the KA19 studio. They are employees of the Ventura County Emergency Medical Services. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Before we start off with all the questions about your jobs, can you each tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am a born and raised California native. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, went to college at Cal State in Northridge. Now live in Simi Valley, have worked in Ventura County in some capacity, either as a paramedic or now what I do with the Ventura County EMS agency for the last 15 years. Guess a little bit else. As far as hobbies and things that I like to do outside of work, I really enjoy projects at this point at the house, building things outside. So I build a lot of planter boxes for gardens and things like that. So I think my hobbies have changed over the years. I used to race outrigger canoes, but I'm a little started having some shoulder problems, so don't get to do that anymore. But I guess that's a little bit about me.
And I was actually born in Germany. My parents were both in the Army, so I lived there for a couple years. Moved out here when I was 3 years old, and I've lived in Southern California ever since. My wife is a nurse. She works at Los Robles Hospital here in Thousand Oaks. And we have a son. We live in Camarillo. Our son is a freshman at Rancho Campana High School in Camarillo. And as far as hobbies and things like that, I'm really big into Boy Scouts. I'm a scout master for a local Boy Scout troop in Camarillo. So with that comes camping, hiking, backpacking, all kinds of things. I also have a bunch of home improvement projects that I really love working on. So keeps me pretty busy.
Wow, that's so cool. So you both are very physically active people.
Yeah. Yep.
That's so cool. All right, so let's get into the questions. What is your role in the Ventura County EMS? Is there anything that prompted you to join this line of work? Basically, how did you get started?
For me, I wanted to be a paramedic ever since I was 3 years old. So I've been in EMS since 1999. I've spent my entire career here in Ventura County. I went to EMT school in Simi Valley and paramedic school in Ventura College, and I've worked exclusively here in the county ever since. I worked on the ambulance as a paramedic on the ambulance. I worked on as a paramedic supervisor. I flew with the Sheriff's Department for 7 years, which I believe they'll be coming out here in the near future, so you guys can meet them. So I was a flight paramedic with the Sheriff's Office for a number of years. And I've been in my role as the Deputy Administrator at EMS since 2010, so just about 12 and a half years. So I love helping people. I love serving the community. And, you know, the fact that I get to do that as a paramedic and work in a variety of different areas and work with a bunch of great people, I think is tremendous.
Say my path was a little less linear for ending up in this spot. I actually, at your age, wanted to be an architect. I still have all of the drawings on graph paper of all of the houses that I'm going to still build one day. But when I was in eighth grade, I actually got hurt and ended up having my first knee surgery. And so that really shifted me into the health field and being really interested in what happens when people are injured and what it takes to go through rehabilitation. Right around the same time, my dad was diagnosed with cancer, and so one of the things that I did to kind of work through that diagnosis was I did a health report on what he was going through, had the opportunity to interview his doctors and nurses and really understand kind of what that process was. So it really shifted me from the interest that I still have an interest in architecture, but really shifted me more towards the health field and doing something with that. Had my second knee surgery when I was in high school. So I had originally wanted to become a physical therapist. Went to college and got a degree in kinesiology with an emphasis in athletic training. So really had a interest going that direction. But it just didn't feel like the perfect fit. And I had a friend at the time who had just become an EMT. And every time I would hear the stories that she would say of the things that she was experiencing and doing, I just thought, you know, I think that's the right path for me. So I ended up going through an EMT program out in the San Fernando Valley. Started working as an EMT in LA County. And I still remember my very first call that I went on, a 911 call, and I knew from that moment that I wanted to go to paramedic school and that that was just the direction that I was going to head. So went through paramedic school through the UCLA program and then came out here in 2007 as a paramedic. Worked through as a paramedic, a field training officer, so I did a lot of training for the new paramedics and EMTs. And then I was the clinical manager for American Medical Response here in the county for about 5 years, where I oversaw all of the training and education that we provided to them. I started with the EMS agency about 2 years ago, so that's a completely different role. Really, we're out of the field at this point and don't necessarily run day-to-day 911 calls. But now my role is really seeing the whole system of care. So I'm responsible for our specialty care patients who are our stroke patients, patients who are having heart attacks, trauma patients, cardiac arrests, and really follow what that path was all the way from when somebody called 911 through to when they get hopefully discharged from the hospital and what that pathway of care looked like, and work with all of the providers, pre-hospital providers, EMTs, paramedics, and the nurses and doctors for what we can do to make that care the best we can.
What characteristics and traits are required or helpful in order to be successful in the field?
Well, a few stand out to me. I think one of the first things is you have to be able to communicate with a large amount or different people, all ages, different backgrounds, and be able to talk with them and find out what's going on and build trust with them so that they can share any type of medical emergency or sensitive things with you and that you can take care of them. So being able to communicate, being trustworthy, I think you have to be able to work with a team, but also lead a team, because sometimes you're there as part of the team that's taking care of the patient and not necessarily being the lead, but then there are times where you might be the person in charge of taking care of somebody, and have to direct others what to do. So I think those are a few of the characteristics that come to mind. Also, you have to be able to be self-motivated. When you're working out in the field in an emergency setting, I would go days when I was working on the ambulance without seeing a supervisor. Wow. I might not see somebody who was in charge of me for multiple shifts. And so you have to show up and be able to check out your unit, make sure you don't have anything expired, clean things, keep your station ready to go, get your paperwork completed, and do that without somebody putting any type of, forcing you to do that type of thing. You mm-hmm. have to be able to know that you are doing that and that that's what's expected without anybody telling you that's what you have to do.
Flexibility is a really important characteristic. The patients that we encounter from one call to the next, the issues that we encounter from one call to the next really require you to be able to change and adapt in a very short amount of time. And you also have to be able to think critically. You have to be able to, as Adrian mentioned, you get a lot of information in a very short amount of time. You have to be able to chop that information up and process it, and then very quickly determine which route you're going to go down in terms of the care that you provide. So you're building relationships, you're building trust in a very short amount of time. You're also getting a flood of information in, and you have to do all of these things. And really, a typical call will last less than an hour. So from the time you're dispatched to the time you arrive on scene and make contact to the time that you're transporting the patient to the hospital, all those things, is 45 minutes to an hour. So mm-hmm. you're doing a lot of things in a very, very short amount of time. So it's flexibility, excellent communication. You have to really be able to speak clearly and have this back and forth dialogue, and it's super important.
Okay, so like multitasking is very important.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay. From our research, there are several different roles that are part of the EMS. I imagine that there's some sort of similar training that is involved and something that is different for each of those roles. Can you share with us like the different roles in the EMS and what are the different training that is involved for those roles?
So there's a lot. Emergency medical services is pretty wide area that you can get into, from dispatchers. So you met with the sheriff's dispatchers previously. They are the first point of contact when somebody calls 911. It goes through the law enforcement dispatch center. Then there's the fire communication center that does what's called emergency medical dispatching. And they will actually give you care instructions over the phone, how to do CPR, how to deliver a baby. You guys might have seen in the news just recently, there was a story from our Ventura County Fire Communication Center that the dispatcher had to assist the dad in delivering the baby, in teaching him over the phone. Imagine how tough that would be to be able to talk somebody through delivering a child over the phone. So people don't think of communications as dispatchers as part of the EMS system, but they absolutely are. They are a critical link in that whole piece. And there's EMTs, lifeguards, police officers are part of that EMS, the broader EMS system. And then there's the firefighters, the paramedics, the EMTs, the ambulance personnel. They have EMTs and paramedics. And then there's emergency medical services on our side, where we're kind of the overarching. We provide oversight, we provide support to the agencies. We don't manage those agencies. We develop policies for them in terms of the care that they provide, and we help just make sure they have what they need to be able to do it. And then there's the hospitals, and that's where Miss Adrian comes in. She really helps them ensure that they have the stuff that they need to take care of the patients, and the most critical patients, our trauma patients, STEMI patients, stroke patients, et cetera. So there's a lot of steps along the way, and there's multiple career opportunities through that whole chain of care. So it's really, there's a ton of opportunities out there.
And so as far as the training specific to each of those areas, the curriculum is a national curriculum, so everybody who's going through an EMT program or a paramedic program, it's built on a national process to where everybody's supposed to get the same type of training and education. Backing it up even further, there's something called an EMR, or emergency medical responder, so that's even something before becoming an EMT. It really depends on where you find yourself in the United States as far as what you can work as or what they require as the basic level, where here, everybody who is part of the EMS system has to be an EMT. EMT programs are typically about a semester long at a community college, but there are some adult training programs or adult schools that offer it as well, usually about a semester long. But there are some programs where it's accelerated, and so it happens faster than that semester type of setup. From there, EMTs then, if they want to go become a paramedic, you actually have to get field experience and work as an EMT and gain some type of hands-on experience, and then you can start applying to paramedic schools. Once you get into paramedic school, again, typically depends on where you go, but that training involves what we call didactic portion, which is all classroom. That's usually a few months, or if it's through a community college, about a semester. Then you spend about a month in the hospital working alongside the nurses and the doctors, actually treating patients and learning from them what that process looks like. From there, you get assigned to an internship where you have a preceptor or somebody who's already a paramedic in the field working and treating patients, and you essentially work under them as a student, but you're in charge. You're doing everything. You're treating the patients. You're giving the medications. You're running the show. And that can take anywhere from 2 to 3 months to finish that process. So from start to finish, from starting as an EMT to becoming a paramedic, at least for my process, that was a 3-year process in total, for start to finish of I could be on my own and get hired as a paramedic. So that's a little bit of the pathway for the education that's involved.
And then there's on the job training as well. We have, in order to maintain our license as paramedics, we have to do 48 hours of continuing education every 2 years, so 24 hours a year. And that's a variety of different lectures, classes that we have to attend, but we're required to submit those hours and show that we are maintaining our education standards in addition to our CPR training and the additional clinical certifications that we have.
What's the difference between EMTs and paramedics?
Great question. Yeah. Emergency medical technicians are sort of the baseline. That's the basic fundamentals. So they are primarily focused on doing good assessments of patients. So a baseline assessment, how to do a medical assessment, a trauma assessment, how to do sort of basic level of treatment, things like that, splinting, vital signs, a lot of different things. There are certain medications that EMTs can give, but those are kind of limited in the amount and the quantities and the types. Paramedics are trained in more advanced assessments, advanced care, advanced procedures and medications. So there's a much broader variety of medications that we can give for a whole number of different conditions. And then in terms of the procedures that we can perform, we can insert advanced airways into people that aren't breathing to sort of secure their airway. We can start intravenous lines, so we'll insert a catheter into somebody's vein and we can give fluids and medications through that. There's a lot of different procedures that we can perform that can help either stop a life-threatening condition or to prevent a condition from occurring.
Yeah, and I would just, each or both EMTs and paramedics function under what's called a scope of practice. So you're given a set of things that you're allowed to do, and think of EMTs as having a smaller set of things to do, and then paramedics not only have that, but build upon it and can do more. So additional medications and those more advanced procedures. So everything an EMT can do, a paramedic can do, and then has additional education to provide additional treatments.
I think people hear EMT and they hear paramedic, and they think, oh, EMT, that's no big deal. That the paramedic is like the where it's at or whatever. And I think what people forget is that the foundation, arguably the most important piece of the whole thing is the assessments and the training and the vital signs, things, recognition that EMTs do is critical. And they, like I said, they sort of form the foundation on which everything else is built. So being a really strong EMT and having a really strong understanding of those principles and those procedures and things like that is hugely important. And in order to be a really good paramedic, you have to be a really, really good EMT and have a good understanding of that.
Do you always go to the same scene as the fire department, or are there times when it's just you?
So the dispatch actually will go through a set of questions. When 911 is called, dispatch will go through a set of questions and determine what resources are needed. So if it's a traffic collision or a medical type problem, really is the start for understanding what resources are supposed to be dispatched to that scene. For the vast majority of the 911 calls, you get a fire department resource and you get an ambulance. So you do get both responding to the scene. There are some 911 calls where through the question process to whoever has called 911, they determine that a fire engine or a fire resource isn't needed and an ambulance only will be sent for those types of patients. Mm-hmm. So that can happen as well. But then we'll have traffic collisions where you'll get multiple fire resources and sometimes one or two ambulances, even more depending on how many patients are needed. So it really is the process that starts at dispatch to determine what those resources are that are needed. We also have a non-emergency type of response where EMTs and paramedics transfer patients from one place to another. So there might be a patient at one hospital that needs to be taken to another hospital because there's different resources available and treatments available at that secondary hospital. And for that, you'll have the ambulance go by themselves to that hospital, pick up the patient, and transfer them as well. And then within that, even more so, there's the ability to have a critical care transport. So we actually have nurses that work for ambulance providers that can do even more than what the paramedics are able to provide and can transfer patients from place to place as well.
So you mentioned CPR earlier, and I'm sure you administer it pretty often. So like, how often do you have to get recertified in the training? Because there are changes in the protocol, and also, are there different protocols for depending on the age of the patient?
So we have to recertify our CPR every 2 years is the minimum. That said, the personnel that are in the field are constantly training on CPR. We actually, in Ventura County, we have a program that we call cardiac arrest management that is sort of a specialized version of CPR. That includes a big team, so the responders that are at the scene, each of those people has a role in a cardiac arrest where CPR is going to have to be administered. So that's sort of a local homegrown thing that we have that requires a lot of ongoing training. So you have a card in your wallet that says I'm CPR certified, and that's every 2 years. Okay, that's the minimum. But that said, there's ongoing training that occurs monthly for us because we want to make sure that the care that we're providing is the absolute best for our patients. So the training is ongoing. There are also non-certification courses out there. So things that it's called sidewalk CPR. So anybody can do sidewalk CPR. It takes 5 minutes. And the things that you learn in a sidewalk CPR, you can go out and you can save somebody's life with 5 minutes of teaching and doing compressions on a mannequin for a few minutes and just kind of learning the concepts and the understanding. Anyone in this room right now could learn sidewalk CPR and then go out and potentially save a life if there were to be a sudden cardiac arrest in front of you. So it doesn't always have to be the certification level. There's other ways to learn how to do it and learn how to save a life.
Mm-hmm. I did junior lifeguards not too long ago, and we learned how to do CPR, but they didn't have money for like mannequins at all, so we did it on sand.
Yeah.
And we did it in partners, and the problem with sand is that you can't get like the full training in.
Yeah.
What do you consider to be the most common emergency that you go to?
So there's, and we look at this every year, and it seems to be kind of the same top emergencies that people have. One of the most common is falls. Patients who fall and injure themselves and need to be taken to the hospital, and broken bones, broken hips, head injuries, falling down and hitting their head. And the next two really are what you would probably think of is some type of chest pain or discomfort, or difficulty breathing is another common one. So those are kind of the big ones that are more common that we will respond to.
Is that commonly found in like older people? Okay. So what's the longest time you've guys gone without having to do an emergency? Is there anything you do to pass time when there is no emergency?
So when I was in the field working as a paramedic, I worked on a busier unit. So I can't say there was ever a shift that I had where I didn't go out on an emergency, but you definitely have some break time. So during that time frame of my career, it would really just depend on what was going on that day. But typically, we could get a workout in the afternoon. That's a nice brain break between running 911 calls to get some exercise in, good healthy thing to do. Depending on what we were able to accomplish during the day, we might be able to cook a meal and actually get a nice hot meal as opposed to hitting a drive-thru and eating terrible food. But I can say I've had plenty of graham crackers and pudding from the hospital for for dinner as well, so really just depended on what that was. With Halloween coming up, if I was working on Halloween, my partners and I would usually carve pumpkins and have a little station pumpkin carving contest, or we would decorate for the holidays and try and do something fun to enjoy, you know, and not necessarily feel like we were just at work all the time. So, and maybe get a nap in here and there.
It's super important for your mental health and your mental well-being to the things that we do and the things that we see or saw. I mean, Adrian and I sit at a desk a lot of the time now, but you know, when you're out there in the field and you're running calls and making these patient contacts, it's taxing on you and it's stressful and it's hard to see sometimes. And being able to get a workout in or to enjoy a good meal with your partner and really have just sort of a time where you can just sort of stop and pause and just focus on something else is critical. I mean, it's super important. So really try to do that. Depending on where you're stationed and what your assignment is, sometimes you're running nonstop and that's really, really hard on the body and on the brain. So we try to take whatever opportunity we can to pause. Even sitting at our desk every day, Adrian and I try to take half an hour and go on a walk, and you know, we're talk about stuff not related to work, because we need that. Your brain needs to be able to focus on something else for a little while and just pause.
Yeah, you guys seem to have like a very stressful job. How do people know when to call 911 versus just driving someone straight to the hospital?
That's a really good question. So I would say, unless you are in the parking lot already of the hospital, that 911 really is your better bet for a few reasons. The first one being, not all hospitals have the same resources to be able to take care of patients. So within Ventura County, if you're having a heart attack, out of all of the hospitals that we have, there are 4 that are specialized in being able to treat those patients. If there's any type of trauma where they need a trauma surgeon or need to go to the operating room or something related to that, we only have 2 hospitals that specialize that within Ventura County. And putting somebody in a car, driving a further distance to try and get them to those specialty centers, if you even happen to know which ones those are, I mean, time can really affect what's going on with our patients. And for EMTs and paramedics, they have medications and different treatments that can help stabilize the patient before that patient actually gets to the hospital. But even more importantly is the process of the paramedics and EMTs being able to call ahead to the hospitals and give them a heads up that they're bringing these types of patients in so that they can get their teams internally ready to go, so that when you get to the back door, you're ready to go for whatever problem you're having. So those are really kind of the main reasons why I think 911 is important, unless you happen to be in the parking lot of the hospital.
Sometimes we get questions about why are you driving by 2 different hospitals in order to get to a trauma center, for example, right? Adrian said we only have 2 in the county. We have 1 in the East County at Los Robles. We have 1 in the West County at Ventura County Medical Center. So why are we bypassing a number of hospitals to get to that specialty center? And why are you taking 10 or 15 or 20 extra minutes to drive that distance when you could be at a hospital in 5 minutes? And Adrian touched on it in the fact that there's specialized resources, surgeons, x-ray equipment, all different kinds of resources and personnel that are trained specifically for the care of a trauma patient. So versus you go to a community hospital that's not a trauma center, now you're going there, you're getting processed as a patient. They find out you have a significant injury that requires the care of a trauma center or a surgeon. Now you have to wait for an ambulance, get in that.
Hey, Sequoia. I'm Noel Wright with Daya Carolyn, and we're your hosts today for our second KA19 podcast. Daya, how are you today? And what's the lineup?
I'm doing great, Noel. I can't wait to start this week's episode of our KA19 podcast. If you remember, we had Debbie Castro, a dispatch supervisor with the Ventura County Sheriff's Department, visit 2 weeks ago. Continuing with similar topics, we have Adrian and Chris in the KA19 studio. They are employees of the Ventura County Emergency Medical Services. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Before we start off with all the questions about your jobs, can you each tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am a born and raised California native. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, went to college at Cal State Northridge. Now live in Simi Valley, have worked in Ventura County in some capacity, either as a paramedic or now what I do at the Ventura County EMS Agency for the last 15 years. Guess a little bit else, as far as hobbies and things that I like to do outside of work, I really enjoy projects at this point at the house, building things outside, so I build a lot of planter boxes for gardens and things like that. So I think my hobbies have changed over the years. Mm-hmm. I used to race outrigger canoes, but I'm a little started having some shoulder problems, so don't get to do that anymore. But I guess that's a little bit about me.
And I was actually born in Germany. My parents were both in the Army, so I lived there for a couple years. Moved out here when I was 3 years old, and I've lived in Southern California ever since. My wife is a nurse. She works at Los Robles Hospital here in Thousand Oaks. And we have a son. We live in Camarillo. Our son is a freshman at Rancho Campana High School in Camarillo. And as far as hobbies and things like that, I'm really big into Boy Scouts. I'm a scout master for a local Boy Scout troop in Camarillo. So with that comes camping, hiking, backpacking, all kinds of things. I also have a bunch of home improvement projects that I really love working on. So keeps me pretty busy.
Wow, that's so cool. So you both are very physical, like physically active people.
Yeah. Yep.
That's so cool. All right, so let's get into the questions. What is your role in the Ventura County EMS? Is there anything that prompted you to join this line of work? Basically, how did you get started?
For me, I've wanted to be a paramedic ever since I was 3 years old. So I've been in EMS since 1999. I've spent my entire career here in Ventura County. I went to EMT school in Simi Valley and paramedic school in Ventura College, and I've worked exclusively here in the county ever since. I worked on the ambulance as a paramedic on the ambulance. I've worked on as a paramedic supervisor. I flew with the Sheriff's Department for 7 years, which I believe they'll be coming out here in the near future, so you guys can meet them. So I was a flight paramedic with the Sheriff's Office for a number of years. And I've been in my role as the Deputy Administrator at EMS since 2010, so just about 12 and a half years. So I love helping people. I love serving the community. And, you know, the fact that I get to do that as a paramedic and work in a variety of different areas and work with a bunch of great people, I think is tremendous.
Say my path was a little less linear for ending up in this spot. I actually, at your age, wanted to be an architect. I still have all of the drawings on graph paper of all of the houses that I'm going to still build one day. But when I was in eighth grade, I actually got hurt and ended up having my first knee surgery. And so that really shifted me into the health field and being really interested in what happens when people are injured and what it takes to go through rehabilitation. Right around the same time, my dad was diagnosed with cancer, and so one of the things that I did to kind of work through that diagnosis was I did a health report on what he was going through, had the opportunity to interview his doctors and nurses and really understand kind of what that process was. So it really shifted me from the interest that I still have an interest in architecture, but really shifted me more towards the health field and doing something with that. Had my second knee surgery when I was in high school, so I had originally wanted to become a physical therapist. Went to college and got a degree in kinesiology with an emphasis in athletic training, so really had a interest going that direction, but it just didn't feel like the perfect fit. And I had a friend at the time who had just become an EMT, and every time I would hear the stories that she would say of the things that she was experiencing and doing, I just thought, you know, I think that's the right path for me. So I ended up going through an EMT program out in the San Fernando Valley, started working as an EMT in LA County, and I still remember my very first call that I went on, a 911 call, and I knew from that moment that I wanted to go to paramedic school and that that was just the direction that I was going to head. So went through paramedic school through the UCLA program and then came out here in 2007 as a paramedic. Worked through as a paramedic, a field training officer, so I did a lot of training for the new paramedics and EMTs. And then I was the clinical manager for American Medical Response here in the county for about 5 years, where I oversaw all of the training and education that we provided to them. I started with the EMS agency about 2 years ago, so that's a completely different role. Really, we're out of the field at this point and don't necessarily run day-to-day 911 calls. But now my role is really seeing the whole system of care. So I'm responsible for our specialty care patients who are our stroke patients, patients who are having heart attacks, trauma patients, cardiac arrests, and really follow what that path was all the way from when somebody called 911 through to when they get hopefully discharged from the hospital and what that pathway of care looked like, and work with all of the providers, pre-hospital providers, EMTs, paramedics, and the nurses and doctors for what we can do to make that care the best we can.
Wow.
That is not as, that's a lot more than I expected. So, besides certifications and training, what characteristics and traits are required or helpful in order to be successful in the field?
Well, a few stand out to me. I think one of the first things is you have to be able to communicate with a large amount or different people, all ages, different backgrounds, and be able to talk with them and find out what's going on and build trust with them so that they can share any type of medical emergency or sensitive things with you and that you can take care of them. So being able to communicate, being trustworthy, I think you have to be able to work with a team, but also lead a team, because sometimes you're there as part of the team that's taking care of the patient and not necessarily being the lead, but then there are times where you might be the person in charge of taking care of somebody and have to direct others what to do. So I think those are a few of the characteristics that come to mind. Also, you have to be able to be self-motivated. When you're working out in the field in an emergency setting, I would go days when I was working on the ambulance without seeing a supervisor. Wow. I might not see somebody who was in charge of me for multiple shifts. And so you have to show up and be able to check out your unit, make sure you don't have anything expired, clean things, keep your station ready to go, get your paperwork completed, and do that without somebody putting any type of, forcing you to do that type of thing. You have to be able to know that you are doing that and that that's what's expected without anybody telling you that's what you have to do.
It's a lot harder than I thought.
Yeah, flexibility is a really important characteristic. The patients that we encounter from one call to the next, the issues that we encounter from one call to the next really require you to be able to change and adapt in a very short amount of time. And you also have to be able to think critically. You have to be able to, as Adrian mentioned, you get a lot of information in a very short amount of time. You have to be able to chop that information up and process it, and then very quickly determine which route you're going to go down in terms of the care that you provide. So you're building relationships, you're building trust in a very short amount of time. You're also getting a flood of information in, and you have to do all of these things in. Really, a typical call will last less than an hour. So from the time you're dispatched to the time you arrive on scene and make contact to the time that you're transporting the patient to the hospital, all those things is 45 minutes to an hour. So you're doing a lot of things in a very, very short amount of time. So it's flexibility, excellent communication. You have to really, really be able to speak clearly and have this back and forth dialogue, and it's super important.
Okay, so like multitasking is very important.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay. From our research, there are several different roles that are part of the EMS. I imagine that there's some sort of similar training that is involved and something that is different for each of those roles. Can you share with us like the different roles in the EMS and what are the different training that is involved for those roles?
So there's a lot. Emergency medical services is pretty wide area that you can get into, from dispatchers. So you met with the sheriff's dispatchers previously. They are the first point of contact when somebody calls 911. It goes through the law enforcement dispatch center. Then there's the fire communication center that does what's called emergency medical dispatching. And they will actually give you care instructions over the phone, how to do CPR, how to deliver a baby. You guys might have seen in the news just recently, there was a story from our Ventura County Fire Communication Center that the dispatcher had to assist the dad in delivering the baby, in teaching him over the phone. Imagine how tough that would be to be able to talk somebody through delivering a child over the phone.
So
people don't think of communications as dispatchers as part of the EMS system, but they absolutely are. They are a critical link in that whole piece. And there's EMTs, lifeguards, police officers are part of that EMS, the broader EMS system. And then there's the firefighters, the paramedics, the EMTs, the ambulance personnel. They have EMTs and paramedics. And then there's emergency medical services on our side, where we're kind of the overarching, we provide oversight, we provide support to the agencies. We don't manage those agencies. We develop policies for them in terms of the care that they provide. And we help just make sure they have what they need to be able to do it. And then there's the hospitals, and that's where Ms. Adrian comes in. She really helps them ensure that they have the stuff that they need to take care of the patients and the most critical patients, our trauma patients, STEMI patients, stroke patients, et cetera. So there's a lot of steps along the way, and there's multiple career opportunities through that whole chain of care. So it's really, there's a ton of opportunities out there.
And so as far as the training specific to each of those areas, the curriculum is a national curriculum, so everybody who's going through an EMT program or a paramedic program, it's built on a national process to where everybody's supposed to get the same type of training and education. Backing it up even further, there's something called an EMR, or emergency medical responder, so that's even something before becoming an EMT. It really depends on where you find yourself in the United States as far as what you can work as or what they require as the basic level, where here, everybody who is part of the EMS system has to be an EMT. EMT programs are typically about a semester long at a community college, but there are some adult training programs or adult schools that offer it as well, usually about a semester long. But there are some programs where it's accelerated. And so it happens faster than that semester type of setup. From there, EMTs then, if they want to go become a paramedic, you actually have to get field experience and work as an EMT and gain some type of hands-on experience, and then you can start applying to paramedic schools. Once you get into paramedic school, again, typically depends on where you go, but that training involves what we call didactic portion, which is all classroom. That's usually a few months, or if it's through a community college, about a semester. Then you spend about a month in the hospital working alongside the nurses and the doctors, actually treating patients and learning from them what that process looks like. From there, you get assigned to an internship where you have a preceptor or somebody who's already a paramedic in the field working and treating patients, and you essentially work under them as a student. But you're in charge. You're doing everything. You're treating the patients. You're giving the medications. You're running the show, and that can take anywhere from 2 to 3 months to finish that process. So from start to finish, from starting as an EMT to becoming a paramedic, at least for my process, that was a 3-year process in total, for start to finish of I could be on my own and get hired as a paramedic. So that's a little bit of the pathway for the education that's involved.
And then there's on-the-job training as well. We have, in order to maintain our license as paramedics, we have to do 48 hours of continuing education every 2 years, so 24 hours a year. And that's a variety of different lectures, classes that we have to attend, but we're required to submit those hours and show that we are maintaining our education standards in addition to our CPR training and the additional clinical certifications that we have.
What's the difference between EMTs and paramedics?
Great question. Yeah. Emergency medical technicians are sort of the baseline. That's the basic fundamentals. So they are primarily focused on doing good assessments of patients. So a baseline assessment, how to do a medical assessment, a trauma assessment, how to do sort of basic level of treatment, things like that, splinting, vital signs, a lot of different things. There are certain medications that EMTs can give, but those are kind of limited in the amount and the quantities and the types. Paramedics are trained in more advanced assessments, advanced care, advanced procedures and medications. So there's a much broader variety of medications that we can give for a whole number of different conditions. And then in terms of the procedures that we can perform, we can insert advanced airways into people that aren't breathing to sort of secure their airway. We can start intravenous lines, so we'll insert a catheter into somebody's vein and we can give fluids and medications through that. There's a lot of different procedures that we can perform that can help either stop a life-threatening condition or to prevent a condition from occurring.
Yeah, and I would just, each or both EMTs and paramedics function under what's called a scope of practice. So you're given a set of things that you're allowed to do. And think of EMTs as having a smaller set of things to do, and then paramedics not only have that, but build upon it and can do more. So additional medications and those more advanced procedures. So everything an EMT can do, a paramedic can do, and then has additional education to provide additional treatments.
I think people hear EMT and they hear paramedic, and they think, oh, EMT, that's no big deal. That the paramedic is like the where it's at or whatever. And I think what people forget is that the foundation, arguably the most important piece of the whole thing is the assessments and the training and the vital signs, things, recognition that EMTs do is critical. And they like I said, they sort of form the foundation on which everything else is built. So being a really strong EMT and having a really strong understanding of those principles and those procedures and things like that is hugely important. And in order to be a really good paramedic, you have to be a really, really good EMT and have a good understanding of that.
That's a lot more complex than I was expecting. So do you always go to the same scene as the fire department, or are there times when it's just you? And how is that determined?
So the dispatch actually will go through a set of questions. When 911 is called, dispatch will go through a set of questions and determine what resources are needed. So if it's a traffic collision or a medical type problem, really is the start for understanding what resources are supposed to be dispatched to that scene. For the vast majority of the 911 calls, you get a fire department resource and you get an ambulance. So you do get both responding to the scene. There are some 911 calls where through the question process to whoever has called 911, they determine that a fire engine or a fire resource isn't needed and an ambulance only will be sent for those types of patients. Mm-hmm. So that can happen as well. But then we'll have traffic collisions where you'll get multiple fire resources and sometimes one or two ambulances, even more depending on how many patients are needed. So it really is the process that starts at dispatch to determine what those resources are that are needed. We also have a non-emergency type of response where EMTs and paramedics transfer patients from one place to another. So there might be a patient at one hospital that needs to be taken to another hospital because there's different resources available and treatments available at that secondary hospital. And for that, you'll have the ambulance go by themselves to that hospital, pick up the patient, and transfer them as well. And then within that, even more so, there's the ability to have a critical care transport. So we actually have nurses that work for ambulance providers that can do even more than what the paramedics are able to provide and can transfer patients from place to place as well.
Okay.
Like most of these things, I'm not expecting any of this.
So you mentioned CPR earlier, and like, I'm sure you administer it pretty often. So, like, how often do you have to get recertified in the training because there are changes in the protocol? And also, are there different protocols for depending on the age of the patient?
Yes. No. So, so we have to recertify our CPR every 2 years is the minimum. That said, the personnel that are in the field are constantly training on CPR. We actually, in Ventura County, we have a program that we call cardiac arrest management that is sort of a specialized version of CPR that includes a big team. So the responders that are at the scene, each of those people has a role in a cardiac arrest where CPR is going to have to be administered. So that's sort of a local homegrown thing that we have that requires a lot of ongoing training. So you have a card in your wallet that says I'm CPR certified, and that's every 2 years. Okay, that's the minimum. But that said, there's ongoing training that occurs monthly for us because we want to make sure that the care that we're providing is the absolute best for our patients. So the training is ongoing. There are also non-certification courses out there. So things that it's called sidewalk CPR. So anybody can do sidewalk CPR. It takes 5 minutes. And the things that you learn in a sidewalk CPR, you can go out and you can save somebody's life with 5 minutes of teaching and doing compressions on a mannequin for a few minutes and just kind of learning the concepts and the understanding. Anyone in this room right now could learn sidewalk CPR and then go out and potentially save a life if there were to be a sudden cardiac arrest in front of you. So it doesn't always have to be the certification level. There's other ways to learn how to do it and learn how to save a life.
Mm-hmm. I did junior lifeguards not too long ago, and we learned how to do CPR, but they didn't have money for, like, mannequins at all, so we did it on sand.
Yeah.
And we did it in partners, and the problem with sand is that you can't get, like, the full training
it's
in.
Tough.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get a mannequin out here for you guys.
Yeah. We know people.
Yeah.
So, what do you consider to be the most common, emergency that you go to?
So, and we look at this every year, and it seems to be kind of the same top emergencies that people have. One of the most common is falls. Patients who fall and injure themselves and need to be taken to the hospital and broken bones, broken hips, head injuries, falling down and hitting their head. And the next two really are what you would probably think of is some type of chest pain or discomfort or difficulty breathing is another common one. So those are kind of the big ones that are more common that we will respond to.
Is that commonly found in, like, older people? Okay. So, like, what's the longest time you've guys gone without having to do an emergency? Is there anything you do to pass time when there is no emergency?
So when I was in the field working as a paramedic, I worked on a busier unit. So I can't say there was ever a shift that I had where I didn't go out on an emergency, but you definitely have some break time. So during that time frame of my career, it would really just depend on what was going on that day. But typically, we could get a workout in the afternoon. That's a nice brain break between running 911 calls to get some exercise in, good healthy thing to do. Depending on what we were able to accomplish during the day, we might be able to cook a meal and actually get a nice hot meal as opposed to hitting the drive-thru and eating terrible food. But I can say I've had plenty of graham crackers and pudding from the hospital for dinner as well, so really just depended on what that was. With Halloween coming up, if I was working on Halloween, my partners and I would usually carve pumpkins and have a little station pumpkin carving contest, or we would decorate for the holidays and try and do something fun to enjoy, and not necessarily feel like we were just at work all the time. And maybe get a nap in here and there.
It's super important for your mental health and your mental well-being to the things that we do and the things that we see or saw. I mean, Adrian and I sit at a desk a lot of the time now, but when you're out there in the field and you're running calls and making these patient contacts, it's taxing on you and it's stressful and it's hard to see sometimes. And being able to get a workout in or to enjoy a good meal with your partner and really have just sort of a time where you can just sort of stop and pause and just focus on something else is critical. I mean, it's super important. So really try to do that. Depending on where you're stationed and what your assignment is, sometimes you're running nonstop and that's really, really hard on the body and on the brain. So we try to take whatever opportunity we can to pause. Even sitting at our desk every day, Adrian and I try to take half an hour and go on a walk. And, we're talk about stuff not related to work because we need that. Your brain needs to be able to focus on something else for a little while and just pause.
Yeah, you guys seem to have like a very stressful job with like everything that goes on all the time. How do you know when people will like call 911 and how do people know when to call 911 versus is drive someone to a hospital? Yeah, I've tried.
I know, it's a weird question. How do people know they should call 911 versus just hop in the car with the person and take them themselves to the hospital? That's the question.
Okay.
Because sometimes an accident happens or somebody falls or they're bleeding or whatever, and it's like, and I've been in that position before where do I throw you in the car and race to get to the hospital or do I call 911? So that's what the question is. It's a weird, I know, I did not phrase it well. So
no people.
Give me 2 seconds and then ask the question.
Sorry, my brain just is like mixing up all the words that I'm like, what are the words saying? Okay. How do people know when to call 911 versus just driving someone straight to the hospital?
That's a really good question. So I would say unless you are in the parking lot already of the hospital, that 911 really is your better bet for a few reasons. The first one being not all hospitals have the same resources to be able to take care of patients. So within Ventura County, if you're having a heart attack, out of all of the hospitals that we have, there are 4 that are specialized in being able to treat those patients. If there's any type of trauma where they need a trauma surgeon or need to go to the operating room or something related to that, we only have 2 hospitals that specialize that within Ventura County. And putting somebody in a car, driving a further distance to try and get them to those specialty centers, if you even happen to know which ones those are, time can really affect what's going on with our patients. And for EMTs and paramedics, they have medications and different treatments that can help stabilize the patient before that patient actually gets to the hospital. But even more importantly is the process of the paramedics and EMTs being able to call ahead to the hospitals and give them a heads up that they're bringing these types of patients in so that they can get their teams internally ready to go so that when you get to the back door, you're ready to go for whatever problem you're having. So those are really kind of the main reasons why I think 911 is important, unless you happen to be in the parking lot of the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Not that I know that would be a situation where it's just like, hey, can I call 911? Where are you? The hospital.
There sometimes we get questions about why are you driving by two different hospitals in order to get to a trauma center, for example, right? Adrian said we only have two in the county. We have one in the East County at Los Robles. We have one in the West County at Ventura County Medical Center. So why are we bypassing a number of hospitals to get to that specialty center? And why are you taking 10 or 15 or 20 extra minutes to drive that distance when you could be at a hospital in 5 minutes? And Adrian touched on it in the fact that there's specialized resources, surgeons, x-ray equipment, all different kinds of resources and personnel that are trained specifically for the care of a trauma patient. So versus you go to a community hospital that's not a trauma center, now you're going there, you're getting processed as a patient, they find out you have a significant injury that requires the care of a trauma center or a surgeon, now you have to wait for an ambulance, get in that ambulance, and then drive to the destination that you would have gone to anyway had you called 911. So you're actually adding time to the thing and delaying your ultimate care when the paramedic is trained to do that. We have policies in place. We have a system in place managed by Adrian that is designed to care for those people. So that's the reason. And we spend a lot of our time trying to educate the public on why 911 is so important and how to really access the resources you need, regardless of where you live in the county. That's our job to figure that piece out. And we have a lot of training and policies in place to help with that.
That makes more sense. Like, I often see like ambulances driving by hospitals and I'm like, wouldn't it just be easier to go in there? And now I know why they're just driving by, because they don't have the resources.
Has there ever been a situation where there was an obstacle in the way of the emergency, and what did you do to pass it?
So I have, I guess, two that really jump out in my career is kind of responding to a call and immediately having to stop and figure out a way to get to our patients. And one happened at a local college campus where the decision was made. We knew where the patient was, and so we went to the back gate, which had typically been open. However, when we arrived, there was a handy padlock on the gate, to which we didn't have a key, the fire department didn't have a key, and so they actually had to get the bolt cutters out and cut the padlock off so we could get the gate open to actually get to our patient. So there was a physical barrier there.
Wow.
Another one was, so we have a lot of agriculture fields in Ventura County. So I had responded to a traffic collision, and where the car and the patient ended up was in the field, and we parked along the highway. And to get to the patient, you had to walk through what looked like a nice crust of dry dirt. But when you stepped on it, it was about 2 feet of mud that you sunk completely into. So my partner and I we essentially had to trudge through the mud just to get to the patient. But it was definitely an interesting process. And we were covered from, hip to ankle with mud, and ended up having to take the patient to the hospital that way.
Those are the kinds of things you see in movies. Exactly. You never expect that to happen, actually.
And we had no idea there was mud under there, and it happened at the same time where we both stepped, looked at each other, and went, uh-oh, sunk down. And then the only way to stabilize yourself was to take your next leg, and 2 feet into the mud you went.
So you're basically walking on quicksand.
Basically.
Wow, that's crazy. So this may seem like a strange question, but what kind of navigation system do you guys use when you're heading to an emergency? And does it automatically direct you to the quickest route?
So we're dispatched through a application called CAD. Computer-aided dispatch is the entire system from the time the person calls 911 to the time we're dispatched. It's the same system that we utilize. We have all the information on our screen. We have mobile computers in our emergency vehicles, So if I were to get a call, it would pop up on my screen, just like in the ambulance, just like on the fire engines, and I would do all of my en route, on scene, transporting, all of those things would be done through the computer, and all the information related to the call is on that computer, in addition to a mapping, a routing system that gets me from where I am at the time of dispatch to the scene. The fastest route avoids traffic, it looks at the roads, it does analysis and says, okay, you're here, you need to get there, here's the fastest way. There are times where, say if it's a traffic collision, for example, and it's trying to get you down a certain road, but you know that the traffic collision is on that road, you might have to bypass and go a different route because you know that you're not going to be able to get there because of the traffic caused mm-hmm. by that traffic collision. So you have to kind of go around it or whatever. But 9 times out of 10, it's going to say, you're here, you need to get there, here's the fastest way, follow this route. And it'll say, turn right now, just like Siri does when you're driving and you have Google Maps or Apple Maps on your phone, same exact process. If there's a call in the wilderness, for example, and you guys are going to be talking to the sheriff's air unit, you aren't going to have a map. You're not going to have a most direct route. So what you'll get is a lat long, a geo fix for where the patient was last known to be, and you're just basically going to have to plug that in the computer and off you go. So you'll fly to that area and then you'll start a search and hope you find the patient based on that lat long and. But there's not really a routing process for that. You just have to go kind of in a straight line until you get to that area and then do a search.
Okay.
What happens if, say, a patient is unconscious, but you need to know if they have any medical conditions or allergies, and there isn't anyone to provide that information?
So you have to almost turn into a detective. So it depends on where you find the patient. I mean, if they happen to be home, we'll look for medications that can give us an indication of what they're on. Hopefully, if they have some significant medical problems or significant allergies, we'll look for medic alert tags or bracelets that will give us the indication of what happens or what those patients might be allergic to. But otherwise, it kind of can be a guessing game. And hopefully when you get them to the hospital, if you have some type of information as far as what their name and birthday are, if they've been there before, they're able to pull up their entire medical record and look for that information if you're not able to get it from your patient.
So when you arrive to the scene, what's the first information that you have to, like, gather? Is that, like, one of the first information? Like, what are their conditions, or is there, like, something that you have to do before that, or is there a protocol that you have to do first?
So there's not necessarily a protocol, but there is an approach that all EMTs and paramedics, when they're getting their education, are taught. The number one thing is what we call scene safety. So it doesn't matter if it's a trauma patient or a medical patient, the first thing you want to do is make sure that the scene is safe to enter. So you look for clues for things that might be a reason where you need to call out law enforcement, or with traffic collisions that you want to make sure that the vehicles are off and not still in drive, that we have them in park and that they might not roll, or, you know, looking for clues like that. But the next thing you do when you look at your patient is you just kind of scan them and look for what we call life threats. So ABCs, it's your airway, breathing, and your circulation. So is there something wrong with one of those? And then we look to fix that first, because that's something that is something that it's a life threat. So somebody can die if there's a significant problem with one of those areas. So that's kind of the first things that we look for. I don't know, Chris, can you?
No, I think that was perfect. Yeah, that there's... And if we can't, if we're not able to initially fix what's wrong with the ABCs, we really don't proceed past that. That remains our focus until we can correct what's wrong. So if somebody's choking and they have a blocked airway, we don't really go on to the next thing until we fix that blocked airway, because everything else we do is going to be essentially useless until we get whatever is clogging that airway out, because the patient can't exchange air. They can't breathe with something clogging their airway. So that's why A is number one, it's, and like, then breathing and circulation.
It's like building a house where you have to do the frame first.
Exactly.
You have to do step one first.
Exactly right. Yep.
What would be your advice to someone who's interested in a career in EMS?
Look at a variety of options, right? It's not, emergency medical services is not one thing. It's, like I mentioned before, it could be anything ranging from dispatch to working on an ambulance, to working for a fire service, to working an administrative position, or working in a hospital as a nurse or a doctor, right? The EMS, the role of EMS is sort of expanding, and depending on what you're into and what your interests are and what degree of training you want to go through, or you know, just a variety of things, you can go into a number of different areas. Some people are really, my interest has been this, administration, and what can I do at sort of a higher level to help with training and policy development, and just making sure that the folks that are in the field, that are running calls, have the support and the training and the education that they need in order to do a good job, which in turn helps the community, right? They're taking care of the patient. So that has been my interest for a number of years, and that's the path that I went down. Some people are heavily focused in the fire service. They want to be a firefighter. They want to be a firefighter paramedic. So they get to combine the role of firefighter with also the role of and responsibilities of what comes with EMS. So it's sort of, you know, for some people, it's sort of the best of both worlds, and that's a tremendous thing, you know. And some people want to be able to do this in law enforcement, the sheriff's air unit, for example. There's folks that are EMTs and paramedics that fly on the helicopter and get to do search and rescue as an EMS provider on a helicopter, and that's their job, right? So it just depends on what you're interested in and what path you want to go down.
Yeah, I would say in seeking out some of those conversations, our local fire department stations are very welcoming to schools and the touch a truck events, and ambulance providers will bring out ambulances and show what the equipment looks like in the back and teach hands only CPR. One of the first things I did when I knew that I was interested in this was I dragged my mom to a CPR class, and we just went through the CPR class so I could have an understanding of some of the basics that I was going to need to learn. And so I think kind of learning a little bit, or maybe taking some classes to try and understand it and see if it's something that you're really passionate about, is something that, you know, I would definitely recommend doing.
Kind of on a similar topic, what can we do as teenagers to be emergency prepared? You suggest getting trained in first aid or CPR, and where would we go to do that?
So you can take courses if you go to the American Heart Association. They'll have a list of training centers where you can take formalized courses. However, I would say that you don't even need those formalized courses to be able to do something. And learning how to do hands-only CPR or understanding what Stop the Bleed is another program for bleeding control, and simple things. For example, learning CPR, I mean, verbally, here's what I'm going to say. If somebody collapses and they're not responding to you and you're going to initiate chest compressions, you find the center of the chest and you push hard and you push fast. It's as simple as that, and you don't stop. You don't have to remember ratios. You don't even have to have a card that says, hey, I was specifically trained how to do this. It's find the center of the chest, push hard, push fast. If somebody's bleeding and it's not controlled, grabbing something like a clean T-shirt, or, I mean, it would be nice to have something that was sterile out of a package that you could rip open, but not much of the reality when you're kind of out and about. Something clean and putting direct pressure to help stop where that bleeding is happening. Even those simple things, you can make a really big difference. Even, you know, you might not think that you can make a huge difference right now in middle school, impacting somebody's care in their life, but you can. And so, you know, looking at things like that, I think are the way to go.
Wow. Okay. thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to add before we go to our studio audience questions?
I just thank you for having us. This has been great. It's been really nice to talk with you guys.
You're welcome.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming.
I the questions you guys asked, the degree of preparation you guys put into this is tremendous. And for you guys to show the level of interest in the emergency medical services and that you're showing and trying to really get an understanding of what it is and how it works and all of that, I think is just is awesome. And so my hat's off to you guys for being so prepared and just inviting us and welcoming us in. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Hi, my name is Trent, and I was wondering how many people are on duty at once.
So that's a great question. A lot. So if we have, so the typical staffing, let's just use ambulances as an example. We have about 35 ambulances on duty at any given 24-hour period. So those are 911 ambulances. And each ambulance is staffed with a minimum of one paramedic, one EMT. So there's two people on each ambulance right there. Sometimes you'll get three if there's a student or a trainee. Fire engines, there's probably two to three times that, depending on what city you work in or what city you live in. Oxnard, Ventura City has their own fire departments. Fillmore City has their own fire department. And then Ventura County sort of covers everything else. And so there's probably 60 to 75 fire apparatus out there. I'm guessing. I don't have an exact number on that, but, and then there's a minimum of three personnel on every fire apparatus, sometimes four.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm Lila. I was wondering, what's your work schedule? How many days on do you have versus how many days off?
So in our roles now, we're a Monday through Friday schedule, so 2 days off. But when I was in the field, we worked what was called a Kelly schedule. So we worked 24 hours on, had a full day off, then did 24 on again, full day off, 24 on again. So you'd work a segment of three 24-hour shifts with a day off in between, and then you'd have 4 days off on the end of that. And you could do shift trades and bundle some shifts together, so move things around, and all of a sudden you end up with 10 days off. So it really just depends on how you kind of work through your schedule. But for the most part, in the system that we have in place now, it's primarily 24-hour units that work on some type of on-off type schedule, with a few 12-hour shifts built in out there as well. And those start at varying different times. That might be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and so they work that way. But for now, Monday through Friday.
And when I was a supervisor in the field working for the ambulance provider, I was on what's called a 48-96. So I would do 48 hours on, 96 hours off, and then 48 on, 96 off. And that was my schedule. And it all balances out to you work about 10 to 12 days a month is what it basically boils down to. It's just a different variation. In my role now, I'm also Monday through Friday with the added bonus of being on call 24/7 call for 2 weeks out of the month. So 3 a.m, I'll get a text message. It's an incident that I need to respond to or deal with or whatever. And I'll have to go out for that. That's pretty limited, pretty few and far between. But we do, between my boss, our EMS administrator, the county's EMS director, and myself, we share a call. So we share 2 weeks out of the month.
Hi, my name is Mamie, and I was wondering, on the average, what days do you get the most calls?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's a great question. I think it's Monday or Tuesday. So this is our system, right? I think it's Monday or Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken. We've looked at it previously to see what our peak call volumes are, and it's generally the first half of the week. That said, sometimes there's these weird anomalies where we're kind of in one right now where things are starting to pick up a little bit and it's getting kind of busy. Like every day of the week is really busy. But generally it's the beginning of the week is usually the higher call volume.
Hi, my name is Mia, and I was wondering, how do you keep the patient calm when you're taking them to the hospital?
So that goes back to what we were talking about with being able to communicate and understand different patients in different ages. I mean, you wouldn't be able to keep a 5-year-old calm the same way that you're keeping an 80-year-old calm. So with the adult and older population, I would tend to try to get into a conversation with them about something other than what's going on with their complaint or their emergency. They have a lot that they want to talk about, whether they've traveled the world or what they've done for work or what their family does and things like that, and try to get them to talk about something that is not focused on necessarily what they're going through in that moment. For kids, I would try to find something, again, that would take their focus away from what was happening, but in a different way. So one of the things that I always like to do, depending on what was going on with them, and if they weren't super sick, we always have a trash can that's at the end of the ambulance, and we would wad up the paper from the EKG and turn that into a little basketball hoop and see if we could, you know, make it into the basketball hoop at the end of the ambulance. And again, try to do something that might be a little fun and a little unconventional, but something to get their mind off of what they were going through at that time.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bree. I was wondering, are there any actions you've taken in past cases that have affected the way that you take or handle cases today?
That's a great question.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the most important things in EMS is recognizing that it's always learning. You're learning every single day. You treat a patient, you find out hopefully what happened to them, and then you can learn, maybe I should do something a little different next time, or maybe I could have asked this question a little different, or putting this patient in this position wasn't comfortable for them, so maybe I need to adjust what I'm doing next time, and always being willing to kind of adjust and do something different for your patients moving forward.
Again, thank you so much, Adria and Chris, for talking with us today about EMS services. And a big thanks to our listeners and followers. I'm Daya Carolyn
with Noel Wright
signing off.